specifically because I want to punctuate the conversation as much as possible. I'm very lazy about submitting. And I don't usually submit unless somebody's asking me for something. And I don't feel that it's necessary to just intrude in that way. So instead, I wait until there's a time and place, or I seek a time and place for something to be manifested or revealed, and I'll punctuate the conversation in that way. So a volume might come out that appears as new work, and it might be a culmination of work over 10 years. Like my labor issue was all written over 10 years period of time. And while I was working on labor poems, I was writing many other things as well. And then at some point in time, I realized nobody had ever done anything in indigenous labor writing. And I thought it should be a volume. So I would, through my poems, I collected the volume, and I had enough on hand already to do that. And put the volume, so it became the first thought wave. So I see it as really punctuating a larger conversation that we're all in, all the time, and everybody who's written before us, or told stories or song before us, or has been engaged in that, as well as all of you, and everyone who will come after you. It's just a huge conversation, of which we play a small part. That's a long-winded answer. Does it help?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You said in our group work that you often retain the work in your head for a long time before you go to the page.
Mm-hmm.
Once you go to the page, can you describe a process that
Yeah, and I'll fill in the rest of the class. There are some pieces that I feel I've been working on since I was a child in some shape or form. And maybe I've done a bit of the essence of it as a painting or sculpture at one time, or maybe there's been a musical composition, or maybe there's been a story. Maybe not. But I think that things are long coming. And sometimes I'll hear music in my head, and I know that it's poetry, but I'm not sure of the words at that point in time, but I know what it's about. And I'll just begin to let that play over and over until the words are very obvious to me and begin to make themselves apparent to me. So I might work intellectually on a longer piece, particularly the ones that are like 10, 18 pages, whatever, for a great amount of time before I go to the page. Because by the time I go to the page, I'm composing in a different way. And so really to allow the early composition or the precursor to the poem to occur, it takes that time of ingesting or dwelling upon and being engaged and involved with the notion of the idea of it before I get myself fully to it on the page. And then I think some of the techniques that I use once I go to the page is that it's interesting because usually it'll suddenly be very apparent to me. And it might be something I've been working on 6 or 8 months or something in my head, and then suddenly the whole thing's apparent to me. And I get what all of these intricate levels of understanding are revealing. And it's like spontaneous in that point in time because I've allowed it to sit at a different level. It seems as though it's very spontaneous. But it's much more than that. And I think one of the techniques that really helps at that point in time is if I've also done something to reveal it through another guise. So if I've worked with it in story, if I've worked with it when I'm painting or something like that. So I usually have some other level of dealing with the interaction of a particular piece that I'm working on. And this is much more on the longer pieces than it is on the shorter ones. The shorter ones come also musically, but in a different way. Because there's been a bit of a relaxed nature about appearing in the market and putting the work out into the field or being generous with it to punctuate. And in so much, you have time to read tons of literary magazines or tons of magazines that are open to other audience, and you learn where your work fits or where it can make a significant difference if it hasn't fit there in the past. And you learn what's conducive to your work and how your work can be an asset to the conversation that's already going. So it's a bit of being patient and waiting until your turn to speak. define them, and your work will be within the body of work within that structure as well, and we'll continue the conversation post that period. For me, I really enjoy working with Political Affairs magazine, and it's a hardline Marxist magazine, and they know I'm not a hardline Marxist. My sister is, I'm not. For many reasons, I'm not, but she's very well known in that structure. And they don't really care that I'm not, because the idea of the magazine is that there is a combination of thought, and that all of these ideas of thought are working toward the common goal of humanity, and not only workers being uplifted in their positions in life, appreciated, patriotic to honored, etc., equalized, some justice happening for people, but also so that there's a place and a room for the creative aspects of that, and that allowance of time and space for people working in other measures toward those ends. Ingalls wrote essays against poets and writers. You know, so if you were really hardline Marxist, you might have trouble with poets and writers, because Ingalls certainly did, although he was writing very prolifically. He spoke out against it, and it was a waste of the page. And he thought, you know, creative writing was basically a waste of the page. But if somebody wrote something spectacular, he would also write him a letter and say, oh, this is spectacular writing. So, you know, there's a dichotomy within anybody's viewpoints, and what they're putting out is their statements and how they interpret things on a personal level. So you can't be that judgmental with these things. But I really enjoy working with the editors that are there, and whenever I have something to say, I usually, they put in something in mind for a few months or so, and that's about the time that I'm giving them something to run. But also, look at the different magazines or different volumes that are representing your field of purpose. So if you were working in environmental concerns, you might want to hook up with a magazine that that's their sole effort, you know, sustainability, or working against biodiverse manipulation and genetic mutilation of plants, rice or corn, whatever it is that you're standing to support. And make a relationship there. There are some magazines that incorporate both photography and verse. So if you do both, you know, why not make a relationship with that particular magazine so that you can demonstrate whatever it is on the social justice forum you're presenting through the photography along with verse, so that you have a place for your spreads. And then one doesn't have to preclude the other. But I really suggest that in so much that you wait until a time and place where your work is relevant to that conversation, and you feel, again, that you're, it's being generous of you to engage in the conversation, but also to take it to a different level. So don't overdo something. Don't be something over the head, but look for the space where your work can actually propel the conversation in a different direction. And the best thing about that part of working with magazines that aren't necessarily known as literary magazines, although they carry literary work, is that they're read by a much larger population of people. You know, this is in South America. 6,000 people don't show up at poetry readings and scream "Viva las poetas" at you. You know, this is the United States, where poetry has been suppressed. As Karen mentioned in class today, it's something that's very prominent. Betsy Scholl, it's the poet laureate of Maine at this time, and submitted her taxes this year for what was going on with her poet laureateship and her work as a poet, and the IRS wrote back and said, you can't take this off your taxes. It's a hobby. You know, there's this attempt to suppress poets under this administration that is very interesting and very detrimental. But it's also caused quite a bit of hindrance within the publication field and the market and what's happening with literary journals. You know, it's a big ball of wax, but opening up that voice into other magazines that also carry literary work but speak to a wider audience is essential. It really is. And not only will your work be read by more people so that it's moving more people in a social justice sense, but it also opens up poetry as a guide. It opens up poetry as a vessel to more readers who may or may not read poetry otherwise. Okay?
I would just like to know what sort of social activism, whether you're part of groups or whether it's something that you start up on your own. I don't really know exactly what it is.
Both. I'm very much an idea person. And typically, to a fault, what I would say. Typically, there are things that are very apparent that I tend to pair up with several other things that haven't been connected at some point in time. And then I suddenly launch myself out there for no apparent reason and tie them together and make it very apparent this things need to happen. And then engage or call upon other people to assist me with that, and then usually turn it over once it gets going. And stay loosely involved along the way to make sure that it's supported. That's my normal way of working. However, I have been in joint unison with many groups over the years that were, the infrastructure was there long before I attended to it, and will be there long after me. So both. But I also do much more grassroots work and much more individual activism than even the group activism. So much more of the work is personal accountability, personal responsibility, and doing as you see needs done. So something comes up and I will attend to it the best that I know how to do it. Other times people have called upon me and asked me, I got pulled into the United Nations in that way. Mohawk poet, who also has taught here in the past and been a fellow here in the past, James Thomas Stevens, was invited to speak at the UN, and he said he would do it if I could speak with him. And so he accepted only under the premise that I would be a speaker as well. And we have sort of dual ends to the same conversation. So that's happened quite a bit. Different groups of people have asked me to assist them in many ways. I don't want to expose too many groups or people in this conversation. I keep it pretty open. But yeah, so all of them. I tend to start a lot of things. I do tend to do that. You know, these are the things that really need to be done. And people would if they could get to it or run it.
Do you see a difference between a poetry that strives for activism over one that strives for theater?
I don't. No. My publisher always says that it's funny because as far as copyhouse is concerned, they say they hear that conversation all the time, but they don't see it evidenced in my work. But I always write from a humanistic point, and there's beauty in horrendous and the terrible and the awful and the wonderful, and that's all part of living, and they're both sides of the same tale. And within that is a historic element. I mentioned to the class this week, you can walk in any room and feel the history of that room on some level because of the temporal shifts we're in. Time isn't always we imagine it to be. And if we were different species, we would understand the room in a very different manner. And place has memory, and sometimes when you have calamity in place, it's because the place is holding memory, and things have occurred there over a long period of time. It's nothing to do with you as an individual, except that you are to understand this in some way, or reveal it in some way, interpret it in some way. And so most of my work deals with very glorious and very horrendous imagery, and at the same time will typically be part of something historical, which is really a humanistic approach. So I think it avoids that. My work's not really didactic, and I think that's a danger. When you're doing any sort of thematic work, or when you're engaged in a certain manner, and that overrules insight or overrules sensory awareness, then it becomes didactic very quickly, and that can be a danger. And I think that's the real dangerous didacticism. And the aesthetic is different. I don't have a political party, I don't represent them. Human. I know, yeah, it's like, it's so funny. Take care. Thank you for coming by. What is that NPR show, All Things Considered? I always wanted to have a called All Things Indigenous. All things human being, all things human being. So.
You talked about your experience working as a sharecropper and one of your poems, the reading. I'm just interested in
if that was a choice to take on a role, or if that was not a choice to work.
You could work or not work. You can eat or not eat, but that was the work that was there. And that was everything that was around. You know, it was tobacco and sweet potatoes. And you either sharecropped or you worked for somebody who was a sharecropper. And I began working as a migrant worker before I got old enough to get an allotment and sharecrop. So before I was 15 and got an allotment and sharecrop, I was working in the fields already for like 67 hours. And then I got a sharecrop and allotment, and my annual pay was about $3,500, but it was much more than 67 hours than making a season. So, but that was the work that was available there. Off season, I did construction work. I broke horses. I later did commercial fishing up and down the Atlantic. We packed crackers in the factory. But you do what's around you. You work in the way that people work. So yes and no. I wasn't lazy. And working in the fields for me was so much like a ceremonial dance. It was a steady rhythm and a bend and a rise. And right off and be the one sitting in the fields, and everybody else was really sweating, and it helps you endure, you know, depends on where your mind is. And there's something very, it's a physics engagement when you're moving in that way. And if you are within the moment, when you're within the motion, it can be very hard, no matter how hard it is, it can be very hard. And because I understand dance in that way, the work was a little different. And at the time I was doing that, I really didn't know anything else. And so I was glad to help with work. And I was packing crackers, I was glad to have the work. You know, it's important to me to be able to take care of myself. My dad always told us, if you don't know how to do something, then you're a burden to somebody else. So learn how to do things and then show up with God to do it. They won't be stuck so much, so we always happy when they have to do. So yes and no. Yeah. I had a 7-acre garden too, and I used to grow all organic plants and sell them into towns for their health mixtures. It was really funny because the hippies were growing organic plants and they were like really good. They're all buggy and they're just small. There's like no food there, and I'd go into town and I had some really good food. And because I was using indigenous intercropping, we had our own ways of fertilizing and keeping the bugs off. So I was using all the methods in the same fields they'd always been in. So when I took mine, and they were really happy that I came to town because of my side and everything. They would all talk to me about their ways of working and everything. Like, we could do it that way. There's burners in the barns that cure the tobacco to the gold color over a period of time, and has to be done very precisely. And I told a lot of grandmas, they said, why are we letting our kitchens get so hot? Why don't we just put those wash tubs in the barn and put the mason jars in there? Use those burners. And I said, that's a good idea. That's a wasted idea. So pretty soon everybody's using the barns to can. Nobody's houses were hot anymore. You can all summer. They put it in there in tobacco barns and can't sell. So yeah, I loved it. It was good work. It was hard work, but I didn't know any different. Yeah. So it was really tough when I was a kid. I grew up scrapping. I was a tough kid. And I liked being strong, and I liked doing things that people thought I wasn't capable of. I enjoyed it. I had cerebral palsy. I had cataracts in my eyes since I was one. I had a heart condition, asthma. I died when I was 2 months old. And I had a brace on my leg, you know, until I was in grade school. So I liked being tough because it countered everything people expected from me. And so if I could carry 50 pounds of leaf under each arm and I weighed 88 pounds, they were in shock. I loved that. You know, it just made me feel like I could do anything, you know, so I loved it. but I saw a lot of people mistreated in the fields. I was mistreated in the fields, particularly when we did migrant work in Florida, or when we got out of our own region. It all depended on who was real of us and what was going on in that field. That's, you know, it's a big structure. So I don't recommend the work, but I certainly enjoyed that I had it and that I could do it, and I was physically able to do it regardless of the situation or the working conditions. You can't feel bad about what you're doing, because if you do, it will eat you alive. You find ways to take power from what you're doing and use that to help other people around you to do good in the world. You will not only survive it, but it's just more material to use in life. So you gain all kinds of spiritual and personal strength as well as the physical. But I did get to a point where I looked like a monkey. If I took off my jacket, people would run away because they were frightened of me. I just kind of fucking liked it. Before I got all busted up in car wrecks. I always have some muscle in my arms. You know, your body, when you grow up working as a child, your muscle in your body, it's a memory thing for your body, just like place has memory. So if I were to go and lift for 6 weeks, I would be all beat. That's how quickly it would come back. I have sinew in my arms like most females don't have naturally. There's different things that is just there. So yeah, it changes the body, but it's not a bad thing. It might come in handy. You may have to defend yourself by your being active and living active, right? Yeah.
So this is actually in two parts. Could you talk about your awakening into poetry? Like, was there a particular author? And if so or not, could you talk about a lineage of poets that make up a constellation of influence for you?
My dad and my aunties and my grandmas and they're all workers. It is poetry. And our songs are all that. And everything around me, when I was a kid, I learned to interpret in that way. And then the classics were also on the shelf. I will say, when I was an elementary kid, probably around 7, very suicidal at 7. I don't know how many attempts I made on my life that year, but there were quite a few. I did get into folk. And when I wrote The Year of the Rat, Benson Hollow said, we don't have any dramatic people. Yeah, you've got to live this. But it was true because, you know, it wasn't the nursery rhyme type element that I liked about it. He was dealing with tragedy, you know, and it was just on the page in that way. And I liked that, you know. You could take tragedy and reveal it in miracle and make it into something that it really wasn't. So as a child, I think I really liked that. But my true influences were my family members, my elders, my lineage. Then I grew up in the year that Motown was created, you know. That was my year of my birth. Motown came into the world. And there was all kinds of poetry going on in music at that time. People were speaking poetry. Muhammad Ali was citing, quoting poetry. When he moved into the ring when we were kids, you know. Came like a bird, came like a bee. We would tease each other that way. People were speaking in poetry at that era. So it was all around us. You know, I really don't
want to
interpret it.
So that kind of segues into this question, in today's world, you know, when we're coming to poetry, like a lot of us are sort of emerging in this sort of this time period where, you know, I work with a lot of kids, and this is the world they know. This is the world they emerge from. And so I'm wondering if you have this notion of this old time when people were speaking poetry to each other, when it was, you know, very present in their lives. When today, when I look at, like, when I see all the advertisements for iPhone, my MySpace, iPod, it's just this very, very visceral eye. It's a me kind of generation. I guess I'm wondering how would if it's being sort of idealistic, or how could we restructure our thinking? And you know, in my class today, there was actually a discussion where there was this idea like using nature inside your poetry cliche. Mm-hmm. So it got me thinking, like, is that sort of the world we're in, where...
Anthropomorphizing?
Yeah, anthropomorphizing, or I mean, if these things are sort of embedded in the poems, and if the poems are sort of resolved or weighted with beauty as the intention, is that seen as something that was before and sort of in the past, or could there be some sort of continuum of that same process?
I think, you know, it's apparent in every child that's born into the world, from a naked ceiling. And children totally live in imagination, you know? They're in a different temporal shift than we are. And they're always engaging with perception and how to interpret that perception. And they always imagine things to be other than they appear to be to someone who's refined with thought or someone who's conditioned with thought. So I think the crux of the matter is maintaining a level of intuitive quality, curiosity, and the imaginative state that allows us to stay within the continuum of poetry. But I also think it has to do with the need to reveal, the need to dwell. And I think that some people are very geared in that, and that in a repressed society, in a society that has gone back and forth in different repressions, and different genocides, etc. I think that within that structure, the continuum is in the hands of people. And that it's merely the choice of the day to decide whether we're going to buy into what's around us or reveal in a way that becomes more natural to our own sort of beingness in the world. And I think that the historical element is only what we make it as well because of the temporal ideas. History is only in the past if you think of it in the past sense. If it's just a larger part of your collective thought, then it's just a side thought of the day. It's not necessarily far removed from you. And so I think, you know, people can speak poetry to each other anytime they choose to. I typically will send off poems to certain people to try to incite conversation with them, even through emails. And most of the time, somebody will even write back and say, I think you should do so-and-so with this line. Or they'll say, well, thank you for the poem. You know, I think they're other poems. And I'm like, you know, I'm just talking with you. I'm talking with you. This is how I think what you said. This is like my part of what you said. You know, that what I'm looking for is another poem. I want them to come back at me. So we're speaking to each other that way. But I don't really think it's that far away. And I think it's in our grasp, and we can make it happen at the moment and now. We can speak to each other like that all the time if we choose to with thoughts. And maybe we should. Maybe we should decide that if we know other poets who are working in the field that are our colleagues or companions or peers, that it's part of our daily effort with that person to go and speak to one another and stay in the vernacular of poetic advice.
No, it's another sort of question like that. This is a good class that I'm teaching this teaching. Not what was the idea. But I keep reiterating that the language already is infused with poetry, mm-hmm. and that is sort of the way people communicate. Mm-hmm. And it creates as much beauty also as it creates as much of, I mean, what is the opposite of beauty? Not like other things, but just.
We have the same type, yeah, we have the same type of aspect of beauty as well. And it is that, you know, and when you attain status as a woman, you know, it doesn't mean beautiful. Physical presence, but beautiful meanness, much more so. And the language is very image written, and it's very poetic, and it's also very narrative at the same time. So, why does it really preclude each other in a traditional sense? But you know, I think it's just a personal accountability. If you want to be in poetry, if you want it to be most of your day, then you make sure that it is, and you don't deviate. You stay within that structure, you stay within that context, and you remind yourself, you know, be mindful. There's a sign downstairs, right? Be mindful. Mindfulness, it's about a telephone. To me, it's about everything else for that phone. You know, I see it, and I'm like, okay, they say it's about a phone, but for me, it's just a reminder, you know, it's like something that you do yourself for the practice of poetry, you know, and doing exercises all the time and staying within that. It's just a way of viewing the world. You know, it's just it's a way of viewing the world. That's what you make of it.
That's a little bit of happening.
all kind of like excitement that we were grateful for. They would see a happy moment and people were thankful for that moment, they appreciate it. Like, I'm thinking like going back to letting yourself notice more happy moments and all the bad conditions, noticing the good conditions more than the bad conditions. Realize that the bad conditions aren't all that important. Because people find themselves given a job or some occupation that leads them to forget about or appreciate the happy moments. It's those kind of people that I think should sort of not study history, but study how poetry is doing, you know, speaking poetry, speaking willing enough to convey you your feeling of you that can't be forgotten.
You know too what the tragedy affords upon the existing glory is it gives the audience, the reader, a place to understand what's at stake without reading. And so it offsets a reader's inclination to dismiss because there's something at stake. And so having tension within a piece is also very important to revealing the deeper nature of the beauty or the glory of the beauty. Because we need to get there sometimes. We need to work for it. Yeah. But I think that you have to live within the beauty in some degree. And you have to be able to find that in even the most insignificant and even the most dramatic of events. You have to be able to train yourself in that way. But I think that you have to reveal trauma as trauma. And you have to reveal tragic as tragic. And there's nothing pretty about genocide, you know. There's nothing pretty about some of the things that are going on in the world. But there's a beauty in somebody going through that. There's a beauty in something stopping that. There's a beauty that's being repressed by that action. So beauty is in and around and surrounds all of the trauma. And it is the nature that magnetically needs to adhere to the trauma to diminish the effect of the trauma. So it works both in unity and in dissolution of the idea of tragic awareness. But it really does allow audience or reader a place to have something at stake and to be fully invested. Most readers are trained to need something at stake in order to be fully engaged. They have to have an investment. Does that make sense? Yeah, but I think a lot of work that tends to be didactic leaves out that element of beauty. And instead, over the head, you deal with idea. Ideas should be thorough declaration as manifested through imagery, rhythm, musicality, device, revealing of insight of content, of sensory perception. In sensory perception on maybe 32 levels rather than 5. You know, balance, magnetism, all of that, you know, especially insight. You know. And I think that sometimes there is a real issue with things becoming didactic because more and more are left out entirely. And it just becomes that. You have to be able to encompass something in the guise of metaphor, object, image, even rhythm, form, that will bring a reader into the same perceptual state or dilemma that you intend to engage them in, and then provide them an edge by giving them something at stake that's personally relevant to them. That goes back to that narrativizing culture that we live in as human beings that I opened with. Somebody will start a conversation, someone else will feel the need to respond to the beginning of the conversation, and someone else will feel a need to tamper that. And we visit that way as human beings. That's how we meet or fall apart in conversation. That's how we meet or separate or divide. And within that structure, we understand each other and we form allies, and we also form oppositions. And some oppositions are healthy to form. Some oppositions are very healthy to maintain in life, because it gives you parameters in which you can work. But it also teaches you what it is that you're working with. It teaches you what it is that you need to communicate to get through whatever is causing the dilemma, the opposition, that you're having to engage with them to bring your audience or yourself to a higher level of reasoning. So sometimes it's good to develop oppositions and know where they stand and understand your tension with that. In Indian way, they always used to tell us, you know, you keep your friends closer, you keep your enemies closer, so you really understand them. Traditionally, we're ball court people. We invited people to dinner, fed them very well, and played ball, sometimes to the death. You know, everything was settled after. Mm-hmm. You know, we understood each other in that way. And then the people weren't sacrificed. There wasn't random murders going on. It's a place where you could come to terms with the problems and deal with them in that way. So it was very ceremonial at that time. And I think poetry moves very much like that. You have to put the things into a vessel and engage it. And then the audience comes into that and engages on whatever level they need to. Hopefully they're inspired by it and want to do better work in the world, whether it's image and device they're working with, or whether it's something humanistic or social that they need to involve themselves with. And then your work is just that integral spoke that they needed to get to the end of. We're in a larger conversation all the time.
I've been very struck by the poignant ways you use the word reveal since we've been chatting. And this idea of writer as revealer. And I just wonder if you could speak to how you understand what your definition is of the revelation.
Mm-hmm. My son once was sitting in on one of my workshops when I was teaching graduate school in Michigan. And I was doing an environmental segment in my poetry class, and at that time, you know, a place out of town and surrounded by birch woods, and there's a pond with chopper swans on it. So I told the class to come out. There was maybe 18 of them. And use my space for the environmental writing. Because we were near the end of the semester, I knew them well, and fairly well, as much as you can know your students, right? And so I gave them each individual exercises to do, what they were working for in their work, but also the device they needed to work with to challenge them. And my son sat and listened to me speak to each one separately and individually. Each one I also told to have a revelation at some point in the poem. And after they went out into the woods, he was like, you can't tell people to have revelations. I go, well, if you don't tell them to, they might not get around to it. You know? One of the students said to me, well, how do you go about having a revelation? I said, how did they usually come to you? And they go, oh, yeah, I've got it. And they went out and had a revelation. So I think by putting it out there, you're merely giving people permission to do so. And I do think that it's about that. Poetry offers that. It affords that.
I was wondering, going back to the talking about dealing with trauma and beauty, I was wondering if you could address humor in that context, because I find that dealing with those things, a lot of what I do loses a lot of humor, or like I'm not able to access that because things are so traumatic or they are so difficult to deal with, and I'm wondering if you could just talk about that.
I'll give you my answer to that. Okay. Here the guy I referred to a little while ago was a very long 18-page poem about me and my kids getting the plague when they were babies. I was escaping a terrible marriage and with threads of my life hanging when we got out that time. And moved into a place sight unseen that was a rat den, literally. And no gas in the car, didn't know anyone in that state, and was stuck in the country in a rat den with two infants, or one toddler, and fought the rats, literally, with a claw hammer and a glass. You guys are too young to remember, but there used to be 2-liter glass bottles with Pepsi. Karen, yeah? So that's how the 2-liter bottles came out. They were glass. And those were my implements of engagement with the rats. And so the work rats would come out at night and they were diseased, so they danced literally on their hind legs at night. So they would gather and come in through all the holes in this place. and I would fight them. And I slept in a crib with the babies because if I didn't, they would come after their toes and hands and fingers. And there's all the stories in that region of the country about babies losing fingers and toes. So I slept in a crib with them and fought the rats off and caught the plague. And my kids caught the plague, and we survived and made it through. And years later, when I was hearing music, which was a very much a huge symphony in my head, multiple instruments, not only Western, but also indigenous, and it came with such a force and volume that it took me literally a year before I dared go to the paper, partially because I didn't want anybody to know those things about me because I was young. And I didn't want that revealed to anyone, much less somebody that would look at my poetry. You know, I wasn't in the state I am now as a grandmother, and y'all don't really care what people know about what happened when I was young. But at that point in time, there was shame, it was humiliation, you know, it was big. And so I worked in, for all of this time intellectually in my head, as the words began to reveal themselves to me. And at one point in time, it became a very dark, black comedy. And for me, even today when I reread the piece, it very much plays off as black comedy, up until a certain departure within the piece, where it's suddenly apparent that the speaker is the I, and that happens on like the 17th page. You know, suddenly there's this metamorphosis where the speaker returns to the I, and you realize the speaker's been in coma during the entire poem. And so by the time that you end up in the hospital room and get the people up serious or involved in the plague or the speaker and the children of the speaker, it's taken that long to get into it. So you can play out as black comedy all the way through because it's coma talk.
But the last line, absolutely.
Again, there's the comedy again at the end. Do you want to give me the last line?
Better contact with any small animals.
Yeah, the nurse at the end. Our makeup, if you've been in contact with any small animals. So it departs again in comedic sense, but it's determined. Because it's turning something around and using it against itself in a very political manner with comedy. So more than parody, more than irony, more than satire, it's determined at that point. And I think that determined works very well with tragedy and drama. I also think that comedy is sort of inherent to coping. And it's inherent to healing. It's inherent to living in a natural state. Reed Bye's wife is a terrific masseuse. Anybody in here needs to hire a masseuse? Really, I'm serious. Turn off that tape. Let me give a little spiel. She's really wonderful. But well, I was trying to tell her about this car accident I had two and a half years ago. You know, she got very sad. I said, well, it's okay. It was very interesting. You know, she looked at me a bit. You have to put yourself into a state of mind where everything that you're dealing with becomes interesting, or you don't deal. That's coping. And comedy is coping. Humor is coping. You know, when you're really hurting, the only thing you can do about it is laugh. Because if you're going to cry, it's just going to hurt worse. You know, the only thing you can really do is laugh. You're really in pain, and that's about all you got left to you. It's too crazy to deal with. It's too crazy to be in physical form. You know, it's crazy that we're human beings. The world's insane. It's crazy. And it's crazy that we're evolving in this manner. So if you think about it, the whole thing's like insane. You know, as far as we can understand it, we're so insignificant, really. You know, so what kind of comedy mess are we in? We have no idea. And I think keeping a level of that understanding of our faults, our insignificance, you know, our humbleness in the world is very akin to humor. And so it becomes the device through which we transcend, through which we understand, transform, alleviate, and present as well. I think sometimes satire doesn't play clearly because the audience isn't as informed as the writer is about a particular nuance. And so the satire is lost. Whereas if you were speaking to friends who were within the situation, it would be understood. So you don't always know who your readers are, but I think that nothing can be written down. It has to be written up. And therein, humor often plays this the elevating device in which we can connect with partners. Does that help at all? Okay.
Thank you.
I'm so long-winded. This whole audience is at the top.
Thank you.
got two of the books in. There's some more. But the bookstore had a hard time getting in some of the books in time. I don't think I even brought them in one myself. I'm so bad about that. Okay. It was out. He did. He said it would be a month. Yeah. They're reorchestrating, I guess, some of the distribution from the UK to the US, and it's a UK publisher. And I guess the memo cost too much for the store to carry. They don't carry anything over $20.
Not true.
No.
Yeah. That's what they told me.
It's more or less true. Yeah.
Yeah.
The inside
would be
$25.
Really?
Yeah. That's
the memo's in hardback still, so it's 24, so they said it was over the cost of that. Yeah, so. You can order them. If you want, they're out there. You could send it to me, I'll sign it anyway. It's okay.
Yeah. I have a question, and this is in relation to Ellen and I have sort of an ongoing dialogue.
Very true.
But you mentioned once that, okay, there are several Cherokee poets out there, and there's a younger Cherokee poet coming through the ranks, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, how do you write, you said he sounds very Cherokee.
He does, and he does, yeah.
So I want to know what, like, I mean, I can recognize a sort of Navajo poet.
So what are the parameters for Cherokee oratory?
Yeah, well, and then you talk about this goes back into your notion of who were your influences.
Yep.
And how does that play into your own reading of your own work? Because you have a very specific way of reading.
Yeah. And I think my feminine too. And it's that side. Yeah. They also have complications because I'm winged out on my northern side, but we're both eastern in the same language base. And with Santi Frazier's work, who Sherwin is referring to, he's a terrific poet, and a wonderful poet. He's at the MFA program at Syracuse right now, and he's doing wonderful things. Even if I didn't know him and didn't see anything about him at all, looking at the work on the page, I would know that he's Cherokee from the poems that he's writing, because there's a stylistic approach. It's very akin to what the Black Mountain poets pushed for, because they were in North Carolina and they were right next to the reservation there. And the vernacular that was going into the Black poet's work, and I talked about Creeley about this when he was alive. He was a wonderful, wonderful poet. I wish we could have all met him. Just a very wonderful human being. Anna Mary Baraka, who I met when I was here, who was a great supporter of my early work. Learned my first book, was just like a godfather to me. And a literal sense of the word. He wrote me postcards like once a week until I got, my cancer came back and I was too ashamed to tell people about it, and I quit returning his postcards. You know, but I spoke to them about that and they validated everything I said. You know, that yes, the vernacular was there, that spacing was there, that rhythm was apparent in that landscape. Language evolves from landscape. And cultures that are immersed in landscape have the language of the landscape. It's very much a known fact in linguistic studies, but also for people who come from that. And so there's certain nuances and essences within tonal structure, within rhythm, within the way that phrases are broken. If we see it in a page of poetry, we get it in an oral sense. It's from this thought. It's from this background. It's from this lineage. This fits this. And you can hear it looking at it. And he also has a tendency to do something that's very Cherokee, which is take something really traumatic and pair it up with something that has the opposite flavor, and then throws in something about the time before or the time ahead, you know, which is also very Cherokee. There are certain poems of his that are complementary to the poems that I wrote years ago when I was probably his age, that I could pull out, like his Point Off Laundromat and my Voucher Voucher. They're like parallels. You know, it's kind of interesting. But he's definitely within that school of education and within that background, and his thought process is very much working in that rhythmic pattern and space, as well as in the way that the text or the content is being presented. So there's a sense of very terse metaphor, so that something seems very humorous at the same time that it seems very sudden. And there's a sense of very little inhibition about throwing in something that's been an actual incident and may or may not be palatable to the taste. And it won't affect him in poetry, but if he ever goes to prose, the editors will try very diligently to take that down and tone it down because they think the audience can't handle it. They probably won't bother him in the poetry, but they will when he gets to, if he goes to prose, they will, which is interesting. But yeah, it's in the shape of the language, the intellectual patterns, the intellectual shape, as well as the rhythm.
And how does that segue into the South?
It was born there. Yeah, it comes from there. It was born from there. That dialect is very old. The Hua Mound, several areas within North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia. That language has been in for tens of thousands of generations and has been shifting and changing throughout a period of time, that there's been evolutions in many different diameters of understanding the language, and the dialectical shifts have changed, but it's the same root base as Wendat, Mohawk, more specifically than Seneca, but Seneca as well, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, Tuscarora, there's similarities in same language root. Quechua's one syllable off in several words, like they say Seymu, we say Sungu. So when in South America or our Quechua people, I hear we have the same sounds, we have the same base. And so it's a language that stretches all up and down the Americas in the older sense of the word, tens of thousands of years ago. And in the current sense, the landscape in which that particular dialect is evolving is very mountainous. And when you look in the horizon, all you see is rose and rose blue, you know. And there's this smoke that's there in the air that we all know belongs to the men who lied to the women. And that's who they are now. They're the smoke that's there because you don't lie to women. You guys all know this, right? And so within that, the language is, it holds the essences of all of that knowledge of the landscape, but it also holds the essence of the beauty of the landscape. The water there is very different. You don't need conditioner when you wash your hair in the creeks, the rivers. But there's mineral within the water that softens your hair. It's very healthy to drink. And everywhere that there's settlements within that language base, it's near water, it's near mountains, it's near hills. And so that language is developed over different portions of the same type of structure as landscape throughout all those generations. And with Santee, he's Oklahoma band, so there's been a removal as well. But the language is still very continuous, despite the removal. They have different words for things like cars that didn't exist then, or even wagons, you know, and things that weren't quite, you know, a regular part of the community at that time. So anything new has a different word. But the central base of the language is very much mountainous, even though they're out there on the southern plains.
And then he also mentioned, you know, I think it was about how they didn't want to move to southern, but he wants to move to
southern. Oh, yeah. There's an editor that does the Shenandoah review, and which really is Shenandoah. That means deer in Mohawk. And they just mispronounce it. But I was once on a panel of indigenous writers at Washington and Lee University, Deborah Miranda put together, and there were six of us, southern and southeastern indigenous writers on the panel. And one of the comments from the editor there was, well, it would be different if we won the war, and he was like getting into all this war stuff, which is crazy, you know, it's crazy. But we're like, we, you know, because it split up all the nations. Tribes just fought with whoever was going to defend their landscape. North, South didn't matter. It was about the land at that point in time. And so their whole conversation is on a different level. And I really needed to take it to that other level. And so I reminded them that nobody speaks like they do in Scotland, Ireland, or England, from which they came. And that their vernacular is very heavily inundated with indigenous indigenous language. And that really, whether they realized it or not, they were much more picking up from us than we ever picked up from them or ever choose to. And, you know, just to actually put it into a good reality, the indigenous languages that were already here in the Americas have inundated English in every region of the country, in every region of North America, Central America, South America. And those words have come into the language, the thoughts and content have come into the language, the way people phrase things have come into the language, which is why the Latin American poets were impressed by the language that they were working within in that time and place. You know, and Olson wrote about working with Mayan people, Cree worked in South America as well, they all worked with indigenous people, and Mary was around indigenous people, has always been a staunch supporter, Million Man March, and told all those guys, you can't ask for a separate state, that's Native American land. What are you talking about? He said, are you going to take land from Indian people? What are you guys talking about? You know, not to say that he didn't understand the concept, but just again to put that back into some common sense. What are you saying you want to do? And it has very much inundated English. People are not comfortable with that. So they say that they have an accent from so-and-so because of so-and-so, but if you go to that part of Europe, they don't speak like that, you know? They don't have that same colloquialism, that same vernacular, that same hesitation or phrasing that is apparent in that landscape. But the native people do, you know?
I hope it's just the English.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just a moment, we only have 10 minutes till the next event, so it's okay if we continue this more casually, but I need to give at least questions.
Thank you for taking time out of your
so much.
Thank you.